Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Todd Cast. We have less than a week until the Virginia governor's race comes to a conclusion, with former Governor Terry McAuliffe locked in a pretty tight race with the Republican Glenn Youngkin. The race, of course, kicks off the next year of midterms coverage, if you will. This, for me, is sort of like the opening game. Think of it as the first game of the midterm season. You know, it matters, but it won't tell you who wins in the end. So we're going to be looking closely, though, for any indication about where voters are drifting. So joining me today, Larry Sabato, the director of the UVA Center for Politics, editor-in-chief of the Crystal Ball, and Nathan Gonzalez, the editor and publisher of Inside Elections. And by the way, I'll be hosting the Meet the Press Election Night special on NBC News Now on Tuesday night. We hope you'll join us. It's election night coverage for people who care about election nights more than they care about political activism. So with that, Larry and Nathan, welcome back to the Toddcast. So I think Nathan would agree with me that we're going to talk Virginia. Let's talk with the grand poobah of Virginia political analysis first, Mr. Sabato. I was eavesdropping. You guys were already chatting before we got in, and it's something I tend to. In many ways, this was the closeness of this race, Larry, feels like something you fully expected in January of this year. Explain.
Absolutely. The reason we expected it to be close, and I think most people who study elections did, is because a Democrat has great difficulty being elected governor in a year when there's a Democratic president. There's only been one exception. Now, fortunately for Terry McAuliffe, the exception was Terry McAuliffe in 2013, though with great difficulty. He only beat a very controversial Republican candidate, Ken Cuccinelli, by 2.5 percentage points. He got under 50%, and he probably won because there was a Libertarian on the ballot who did very well in that election.
7%, right? Yeah, something like that.
Big that's number. Right. Wow. Robert Sarvin. And he ended up taking enough votes from Cuccinelli to elect McAuliffe. Well, this year, while it looked like Biden was popular, it's amazing the way most presidents by the fall have enough controversies attached to them that they become relatively unpopular, even in states that they won. So that was always part of our thinking. And look, it's tough to run as a retread, particularly in Virginia. We have the one-term consecutive limit. No. Only one governor has ever been elected to two terms, and he barely won for the same reasons that McAuliffe is having difficulty. His president at that time, Richard Nixon, was in trouble. He was trying to present his past record as a justification for a new term. People never want to go back or look back. Mm-hmm. They want to go forward. They want to know what you're going to do for them in the next term. So that's why we always had it as leans D and never what many of the activists said, likely D or even safety, they were arguing, which I think is silly. And I think Nathan agrees.
You know, Nathan, it's funny about the I have a lot of ideas as to why Youngkin will come up short if he comes up short. And one of them is something Larry just addressed. For the life of me, I don't know why they haven't run against incumbent Governor McAuliffe as much. It's in their toolbox, but they've not done it that much. I thought it was the weakest part of McAuliffe's candidacy. And it's a weakness I don't think Youngkin's exploited very well.
Well, I think that's one thing that's remarkable about this race is I believe the combined candidate spending, we've topped about $70 million combined. And both candidates are not they're not well-liked, but they're not completely underwater. Nope. And so despite the negative ads, they're actually in pretty good shape personally. So then it comes down to, you know, turnout issues, persuading what independent might be out there. But one of the things that we know from watching campaigns for years is watch where the money, you know, what are the messages that they're putting their money behind? And you're right. That's not one of, that hasn't been their focus throughout the campaign.
No, it feels like I'm going to try to oversimplify, and you guys either, tell me why I'm wrong or right on this one. It feels as if they both sort of have a simple rationale for how they win. With McAuliffe, it's, you know, numbers are on his side, activate enough Democrats who fear Trump, and the numbers favor you. For Youngkin, it's don't get clobbered in the suburbs, and education is our best way back into the suburbs. but don't alienate the Trump base. Which obviously we're waiting to see which oversimplified strategy that I just outlined prevails. Have I oversimplified it, Nathan?
No. I mean, I think what Youngkin needs to do is what Republicans are going to try to do or have to do in district and states all around the country, right? You can't alienate those people who believe that the 2020 election was stolen, but you also have to appeal to voters who don't, you know, who believe that the 2020 election was a free and fair election, and you need both of those things. That's what he's trying to do, and that's what and that's a microcosm of the Republican side. I think the good news for Republicans, if you look broadly, is that just being close in this race is good news, right? Meaning that Republicans don't need to win Biden plus 10 states to get the Senate back. They don't need to win Biden plus 10 districts to get the House back. And so just even being within a few points, which it looks like it is, is good news overall for the Republican Party.
Is any Terry McAuliffe loss on Terry McAuliffe? Larry, or is it all on Biden and the national climate?
Well, I would say also congressional Democrats. You got to give them a star role.
Oh, I totally agree. Yeah. Whenever you get bogged down with Congress, everybody loses.
Oh, my God. Yes. And they're constantly preening in front of the cameras and commenting. And it's just insane. And they've had months and months to work this out. And they still haven't the week before the election. But, you know, look, Terry McAuliffe is an excellent political organizer. And he was a pretty good governor. I have to say, I was surprised. I didn't think he would be, given his purely political background. He left office reasonably popular. I mean, he wasn't in the stratosphere, but he was well above 50. And given the circumstances of the time, I think that was at least mildly surprising. So I don't know that this has been a condemnation of him, whether he wins narrowly or loses narrowly. I think more it's that he really didn't expect a lot of this because everybody around him, including many of his staff members, told him this was a cakewalk. No, it was never a cakewalk. And then you had other people saying, no, it's not a cakewalk. But I'm just saying inevitably somebody like McAuliffe, who's an optimist by nature, is going to believe there's no way Joe Biden could carry this state by 10 points and I could end up losing the next year. Well, we now know it's at least possible. It's close enough so that that could happen.
Let me ask you the alternative question, Larry. Could another one of the Democrats who ran be in this shape? Or do you think Jennifer Carroll Foy or Jennifer McClellan would be winning or losing right now?
I'm not sure. I probably think they would have lost, or at least they would be about where McAuliffe is. It's possible that it could be just a party election. Mm-hmm. I love those questions because they're all hypothetical. And
of course,
you can never prove
there's no wrong answer. That's right.
There's no wrong answer. By the way, they're already making those arguments privately. If I'd been the nominee, fill in the blank there. But I, look, this is more of a national election being held in Virginia than a Virginia election.
It's remarkable. You know, it's funny you say that, Nathan. I have heard I've done some reporting on some of the General Assembly races, and it's remarkable how nationalized those races have become. They really have become mini congressional races. In fact, I was talking to one pollster who reluctantly admitted in these swing races how much a factor Trump is. Like that Trump is a real factor in these races. And when this pollster pointed this out, he didn't say it as a positive.
That's a continuation of the partisan alignment that we've seen over the years, right? I mean, remember, we used to have two Democratic senators from North and South Dakota, right? The idea that is a distant memory now. I mean, it's all, and there are a few governors, the Governor Hogan's or the Governor Baker's in Maryland and Massachusetts, but those are increasingly rare and endangered species. And that's one of the reasons why I think Terry McAuliffe has still a narrow advantage, because I think there is still a Democratic lean to Virginia, all things being equal. But this is, clearly the circumstances are a little bit different.
Well, Larry, and the early vote alone, I mean, I don't think people fully realize just changing the rules of this election. It's the first time early vote's been had 6 weeks of early vote? I mean, my gosh, the McAuliffe campaign can basically Trust me, our house hasn't voted in Virginia. I get reminded all the time with flyers.
Yeah. Now, Chuck, you're one of the few people who would realize the impact that has. It's rarely been mentioned, but it's a big factor. And as with Nathan, it's why we've slightly kept it in the McAuliffe category. They've been doing very well of late in places like Fairfax County, where they must do very well with the early vote. And yes, it matters. It accumulates daily. And as you pointed out in the beginning, there are simply, in modern Virginia, more Democrats than Republicans. So if you get a turnout rate that's even close to being equal, the Democrat wins. Well, for a while, because of the lack of enthusiasm on the Democratic side generated from Washington, it didn't look like Democrats were going to be able to do that. And they may still not, but they're a lot closer to doing it today than they were 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Chuck, if I get one thing we're going to have to watch after the election is what happens in the election and what the politicians or the party strategists think happened in the election might be two different things. But what the politicians and the strategists think happened, I think, is actually more important, because that's going to guide their future behavior going into 2022. You know, this gets into national or local. If it all ends up being blamed on Terry McAuliffe and the, you know, partial sentence that he said during a debate, then that's one thing. But if it becomes about Youngkin and his message in the suburbs and crime and education, and, you know, then that is going to be the blueprint that's taken, you know, blueprint that moves to 2022 again. So what we decide happened might be different than what the parties decide. And we got to listen. This is a case where we have to listen to the politicians.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I've thought this. You know, I go back to a few things I think Youngkin could have done. You know, I'm in this camp that he's going to come up short. And I think you guys are too. Just the numbers are the numbers. You know, in some ways, it's like reverse Texas, right? You just, no matter how close the polls showed Beto O'Rourke back in 18, we were like, yeah, but the numbers are the numbers. You know, there's just more voters, potential voters for the Republican side than there is for the Democratic side. And that at the end of the day is what we're looking at. But I what I'm curious about, Larry, is, you know, Youngkin's advisors, Nathan brought up Larry Hogan and Charlie Baker. And I also think a candidate is, Youngkin's advisors are people that have worked mostly in red states rather than in blue states. And they believe, and so in red states, you can't alienate the Trump base and win. I don't know if that's true in a blue state, right? Which we're going to find out. And, you know, for instance, I thought if Youngkin had simply embraced the mandate, that would have been a way to distance from Trump without having to say Trump's name. He was a CEO. Why? What CEO wouldn't want to have a mandate type of thing, et cetera, et cetera? You know, and I do think he's getting whispered into his ear a bit too much. Don't alienate the Trump base. That'll cause you more problems. And that's one of the after action reports I'm curious about if Youngkin comes up short.
Chuck, as you know, there are quite a few former Trump campaign aides and Trump administration people in the top echelon of the Youngkin campaign. And one of the smart things they think they've done is to stay in close touch with the people who are right now around Trump, who are also whispering in his ear and keeping him away from Virginia, and also keeping him saying good things about Youngkin. The problem is, they all think it's fine when Donald Trump endorses Youngkin for the fifth time. They think it's fine that Youngkin has been taking some positions that remind people of Trump, and positions that are well to the right, I think, of the Virginia mainstream. I agree with you. He had an opportunity not to become a Charlie Baker, because he isn't.
He didn't have to do that.
His image. Would have enabled him to be a true moderate if he wanted to be. He was a blank slate.
Actually, if you're a moderate, just an independent. You don't have to be a moderate. You could be an independent. Right? He wants to be a political outsider. Well, an independent businessman might pick the vaccine mandate, you know?
Yes, yeah. or at least come closer than he's done. I've been interested to watch the evolution. He got stuck in the Trump hole back when he was seeking the nomination. And I'm sure he would take back some of the things he said, just like McAuliffe would take back that line about keeping parents out of school, what the school should teach. but it's too late. Once you said it and it's on the public record, and also you never talk to supporters and assume they're really supporters and are not taping you.
Yeah,
that's where experience in politics helps.
I'm going to pause it right there because we'll be right back after a quick break. You're listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press.
If you ever needed to be persuaded that bad things can happen anywhere, then take a journey with us.
From compelling mysteries to in-depth investigations, our Dateline episodes are available as podcasts.
Follow Dateline NBC now to get new episodes every Tuesday. To listen ad-free, subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com.
Great storytelling with a twist from the true crime original.
Join Hoda Kotb for a brand new season of her podcast, Making Space.
For season 5, I am making space to talk to people who are providing a sense of hope and inspiration when life changes course.
Uplifting conversations with inspiring individuals like NFL legend Drew Brees, singer-songwriter Ziggy Marley, and today's show co-anchor Savannah Guthrie as you have never heard her before.
I found faith more viscerally, not because the bad thing didn't happen, but because it did.
I promise you, like me, will leave these conversations with some wisdom for your own journey, empowered and inspired to make space in your own life.
New episodes of Making Space with Hoda Kotb are released every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Nathan, we've not seen abortion. A lot of us a month ago, I'll tell you this, I mean, I even joked 2 months ago, I don't know if I would have asked about abortion in any debate I moderated. By the time I had to moderate the debate, I felt, my gosh, abortion was enough of a conversation. The history of abortion and Virginia elections is pretty fresh in my head, but I'm an old head. At least Larry and I are older heads these days. And
you're not 70, Chuck. Don't
I understand that. but I ain't 30 either. So I was at a, just a quick aside, I was at a family wedding this weekend, and I was decidedly not on the younger side. It was like I was with the old aunts and uncles because I'm an older aunt and uncle. Like, it was just one of those moments. It was like they literally separated the dance floor between the younger folks who would be there all night and the older folks who were going to figure out how to leave.
You'll be at the big table for Thanksgiving, though. That's the good news.
Yeah, exactly.
You won't be with the kids at Thanksgiving.
I've been stunned, Nathan, that abortion hasn't been part of the closing message for McCollum.
Yeah, but I wonder if it just the news in and of itself. I mean, let's say where would that message play the best? Probably in Northern Virginia. Right. Probably where folks are paying more attention to the news. They realize, you know, Supreme Court, SB8 in Texas, yeah. Mississippi, and that, you know, if that is their energizing issue, that they realize, you know, what is at stake, or they're going to be motivated. I think largely, or looking broadly at the enthusiasm gap, I think it's clear there's a Republican advantage. But I'm wondering, you know, we have to remember that an enthusiastic vote and an unenthusiastic vote count the same, right? So as long as unenthusiastic Democrats get out to vote, then, you know, McAuliffe should be okay. But there are still some that are clearly haven't quite made up their mind, made up their mind of whether they're going to vote or not, not whether who they're going to vote for.
You know, Larry, Chuck, yeah. Hey, Chuck, and I had one thing on the abortion thing. McAuliffe's had a lot of bad luck in this campaign. A lot of things have happened that have not helped him. But he's gotten one piece of good luck that nobody's focused on. The day before the election, election eve, November 1st, the Supreme Court will be hearing arguments about the Texas abortion case. And it almost, they're not going to make a decision. It doesn't matter what's said. What matters is in the headlines, on TV, in the newspapers, abortion will be the lead story leading into election day. And loads of people will vote on election day.
So do you expect, so Larry, one of the things I was going to ask you about, which is sort of in 12 years in Virginia, we went from, think about where Creed Deeds was at this point in time with a week to go in the campaign, and Barack Obama was in a terrible place in his presidency. Here we are 12 years later. Joe Biden's not in a great place in his presidency, but Terry McAuliffe is light years stronger than Creed Deeds was at this point in time. Is that a reflection of changing Virginia? Is that a reflection of McDonnell was a better candidate than Youngkin? Or is it just simply a different era?
Well, it's both a different era and changing demographics. It's a combination, different values. You couldn't run a campaign on the things McDonnell ran on other than jobs, Bob for jobs.
Right.
But the social issues really don't sell nearly as well as they did in 2009, which I think the Youngkin people might be discovering. I don't think it really has as much to do with McDonnell versus Deeds, although Deeds was a worse candidate than McAuliffe because he's had a lot more experience. But yeah, you know, look, Virginia has changed so dramatically, really in about 12 years, that you have a hard time keeping up with it. And it's still changing.
Right.
The demographics change every year more in the Democratic direction.
So, Nathan, what's Abigail Spanberger looking for? Right here, she's a Virginia member of Congress, 7th congressional district, swingish, very swing district, Virginia Beach, a little bit of Virginia, not quite Virginia. Wait, two
doesn't quite go that far.
Excuse me, that I'm conflating the other swing district, but I put her out there because she's emblematic of Alyssa Slotkin, right, in Michigan, and all these sort of these swinger House districts. There aren't many of them, but they're going to decide the majority. I mean, if Democrats have any shot at holding the majority, they got to hold all these folks. What's she looking for in this election? How's she watching? What would have to happen to make you feel better about her chances or worse about her chances?
Well, first she's looking for what her district is going to look like, right? That is still in limbo with the commission mess. But broadly, looking at the suburban voters in her district and the ones that have been clearly repelled President Trump or anything to do with President Trump, but are they coming back? You know, are they returning to maybe their Republican roots? Mm-hmm. And to me, this is where that Democratic Congress comes in, that there's clearly, whether it's in Nova, in Rico County, Orange County, California, wherever it may be, there was clearly a push against Trump in the suburbs. But now some of those voters, do they have buyer's remorse on the Democratic side? They look at what Democrats in Congress, some of them are trying to do and said, wait a minute, this is why I voted Republican for so many years, because I knew Democrats are going too far. They're trying to go too left. And if that is, if that is why there aren't going to be enough Democratic votes or as many Democratic votes there, then that's a problem for her, I think, in 2020 or 2022.
This gets me back to messaging, Larry. And I think the Democratic Party, it's interesting. Climate change is an existential threat. It's real. It's major. It's huge. We got to worry about it. Income inequality is becoming so problematic, it could turn into one of these threats that could upend society. Donald Trump and the democracy is also feels near term, feels present, feels of the moment. I almost feel like Democrats sometimes don't know which emergency to rally around. Meanwhile, they're also debating should paid leave be 4 weeks or 12 weeks. And I say this, what will this all look like in 3 years, right? Are they going to look back and say, should we just have made the entire party platform about saving the democracy and everything else falls by the wayside?
If I had to pick among the issues you mentioned, personally, I'd pick climate change. Politically, I would pick precisely what you have just suggested. Mm-hmm. We're on the edge. The United States is on the edge, potentially, if things move the way they might move with Trump in 2024.
Not everybody believes this, though. That is a problem, even inside the Democratic Party. It doesn't unite the Democratic Party wholly, right? You do have those that believe, even I think Joe Biden thinks this at times. Oh, no, we're going to bring normal back.
Yeah, that's true. They are a little bit too optimistic. But I think on the whole, people have gotten the sense that we're on the edge, that the Republic could be in danger. 2022 may show us how it will happen if the Trump people running for Secretary of State in the swing states actually win. Mm-hmm. That may be a better argument after 2022 heading into 2024. Yeah. But, I've heard people all during this campaign say McAuliffe is spending too much time on Trump.
I've heard that too.
Spending too much time making Youngkin into Trump. But you know what? If he holds on, it's going to be precisely because he made Glenn Young and into Donald Trump. His closing ad shows as much. Yeah. They've gone back to that central argument.
Nathan, I've just noticed this with Democratic strategists. They don't know how, you know, they want to do all of it, right? Like they want to say, look, it's all important. And I get it too. But you can feel it. You can see it. It's sort of like there really is disagreement about how to galvanize the public. Look, I think the Trump, I think galvanizing the public with Trump is harder without him on social media. Like I have this theory that says if Donald Trump were on Twitter right now, Joe Biden's approval ratings would be 5 to 10 points higher. Just simply, we'd be reminded more every day, those independent voters who don't like all the spending that's going on, don't love Congress, so they're punishing Biden over this. The threat of Trump would be, oh, that's right. That's why I voted for Biden, right? That sort of reminder. I don't know what the right answer is, but I'm wondering what you think the debate, what the debate's going to be like about this, about Democratic messaging.
Well, I think one thing, when I look back at 2010, for example, in the Affordable Care Act, and Democrats were, kicking things around on the Hill. And one difference I see from to right now is that if Democrats can pass something, that they will actually go out on the campaign trail of sort and try to sell it. I think President Biden will try to sell it. Remember, 10 years ago, Democrats passed the ACA and then forgot about it or even ran away from it. And so I think it's critical that Democrats do pass something and have something to show or, you know, to try to demonstrate to voters what they have done with the power that was entrusted to them in 2020. Because if they, the argument of 2022 will be whether those programs or that spending is effective or not. But I just interviewed Val Arcouch. She was running for the Senate in Pennsylvania. One of many Democratic candidates. And I know she was frustrated that Democrats have basically let the conversation be about the spending, be about, is it 3.5, is it 1.9, is it 2. Whatever, instead of focusing on what the actual, you know, bill is going to do for the American people, right? That's the key. When we're talking about climate change, have Democrats connected the dots? How is this going to impact, you know, the average American? And I don't know that that's there.
Well, yet. Larry, though, I would argue, it's interesting you bring up 2010, and I always say, you know, Democrats lost control of Congress due to healthcare in 2010 and won control of Congress, some would argue, because of healthcare in 2018, although I think a lot of us would say Trump was a equal, if not bigger, factor, and I think history will say it was a bigger factor. I don't know, Larry, if you can run on anything you've passed because people don't see the benefit yet. That's my only, it took a decade for folks to understand the benefit of the ACA.
Well, the other problem is, as people keep mentioning, nobody knows what's in the bill. And the reason why people don't know what's in the bill is because the leaders don't know what's going to be in the bill.
That's a fair point.
You know, things drop in, things drop out. You can't sell a product if it's not ready for the shelf. What Nathan said is a good point. They have to present that. But I think they're on solid ground when they show the threats that are coming. You mentioned three of them. There's a lot of unrest in society about the tremendous inequality. There is great concern, at least among the people who really follow this subject, that we're being engulfed by climate change so severe we may not be able to recover from it. But you get back again to democracy, the threats to the future of democracy and to the republic itself. And if you can't make that argument, you don't deserve to win.
Well, I argue you can't solve climate change and income inequality if you don't have a functioning democracy.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, that's sort of, all right, last question. Our out question is this. There is no one region in Virginia that tells a whole story, but give me how you're watching election night, Larry. And Nathan, I'll start with you, Nathan.
Trying to watch it all. I think the race is so close that the margins are going to matter. And Larry could probably walk through the region, the geographic breakdowns, but it's not just how well does Youngkin do in Northern Virginia, right? He needs to run up the score in South and Southwest Virginia. And so, it's all of the above to me on geography.
By the way, before I go to Larry's answer in Virginia, What's the Democrat hand ring line margin of victory for Phil Murphy? 5 or less, and it's like, anything over 5, and it's like, meh, ignore? What is it? Seven? You know, do you have a line that tells you whether they should get nervous?
Well, if it's five or less in a state that Biden won by 15 or 16, I think that's you know, something the Democrats are going to need to examine. So I think it's got to be high single digits or greater, you know, to just sort of move along to the next race. Right.
So Larry, how you watching election night? I mean, I know that, you know, one of the things we're trying to warn our folks on is, hey, Youngkin's probably going to be leading as the returns come in until somewhere in the 10 o'clock hour when Fairfax County comes in, starts to come in. And that's the question. But how else are you going to be, you know, what in those early returns, the non-Northern Virginia returns, are you going to be watching to give you a clue, give you a hint?
Well, they've actually made a change, Chuck, and haven't well publicized it for Fairfax County. Believe it or not, the first results on election night are going to come mainly from Fairfax County early voting. Yes.
Oh, wow. And that's a big deal. That's a change in how we've all noted the way
it's
Virginia
a big
counts.
Change. Yeah. It's a big change. And so McAuliffe will be doing very well at first. I think he has to worry about when the rural areas and some of the key suburbs, like, for example, Chesterfield in the Richmond area.
Right.
Chesterfield is the most Republican of those counties.
The Loudoun of Richmond, right? You know,
the Loudoun of Richmond. Yeah. But Democrats have been getting around 50% of the vote there for a few elections. I think Youngkin is bound to carry it, and I want to see how heavily he carries it. You know, if this is a 60-40 in Chesterfield, McAuliffe is in trouble. If it's relatively close, if it's 53-47 Youngkin, then I think McAuliffe can survive if he does well, does at least break even in places like Virginia Beach. He'll lose Virginia Beach, but, you know, if he can get 46, 47, 48%. So I'm going to look to places like that for an early indication.
Can the House of Delegates, can Democrats lose the House of Delegates and win the governor's mansion, in your view, Larry? Is that feasible?
It's unlikely.
Yeah, okay.
It's unlikely, but it's feasible. Okay. I've looked at the races, and there are enough Democrats hanging on in districts that Youngkin may carry so that you could have a mixed result like that, but not if McAuliffe wins by, you know, 3, 4, 5 points.
Got it.
But I don't think he will.
Not a bad primer, guys. Nathan, Larry.
It was fun.
Yeah. Are we going to know before midnight?
I sure hope so.
Nathan?
I'm the old man. I don't know.
I got an election special. We say we're going to end at 11, but I don't mind going to a little overtime.
Chuck, this is what I'm hoping for. And usually this is not controversial. I just hope we agree
on who, win
on
or
who
lose.
Wins and who loses.
There you go.
That's it. That's all I ask for.
There you go.
Good point.
Let's have some faith. I think Virginia is one of the best counting and reporting states in the nation. I hope people remember that. All right, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Gilpin Green and Matt Rivera. John Reese is our executive producer, and our theme music composed by Spoke Media. You can catch Meet the Press daily on MSNBC every day at 1 p.m. Eastern. DVR it if you'd like. Meet the Press Reports is on demand whenever you want it on Peacock. And the big show's available every Sunday morning. So thanks for listening. And until we upload again.